Hi and welcome back. This is episode number 294. Today I had a fantastic conversation with Igor Burushko. He is the co-founder and producer of the Running Remote Conference. Now, the conferences were in-person physical conferences until Corona happened. They were going to have a conference in April this year, and they, of course, had to cancel it just 1 month out. They quickly pivoted though, and they have since done two online conferences, so we discuss that. I am passionate about the topic that he is passionate about, which is remote work and what that means for the economy and the future workforces. We delve into what remote work is, what distributed teams are, and its implications for the future of work. So I had a fantastic conversation with Igor. I learned a lot and really enjoyed it, and I hope you will too. If you want any of the show notes, as always, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. Just before we begin, if you find this conversation informative, valuable, enjoyable, please share it. Share it with friends, colleagues, or family. Anyone that you think can find value from learning more about offshore outsourcing and offshore staffing and how it can benefit them and their business and their community. So share it with someone today. Now, Igor, you're a busy man. You're running a seven-figure global business. Explain to me where you're sitting right now.
I'm located in Indonesia, on the island of Bali.
How is it that you can run a business as you do? It reaches to every corner of the globe from Bali. What's the scene like there?
Well, if funny enough, the only problem that I face here is the internet connection. Sometimes it's a bit choppy. I live next to a monkey forest, and so I get monkeys sometimes chewing on the cables. A bit of a joke that I tell on my calls, but it's actually real. Other than that, it's a very inspiring environment to be in. And of course, Bali is full of remote workers and a lot of co-working spaces. And it's been a big hub for the movement. So it's a perfect place for our business.
It's really becoming a vibrant scene now, isn't it? Bali and Ubud, it's kind of teeming with young, inspired, remote, digital nomads and entrepreneurs.
It's, right there on the map of have to go to places if you're a remote worker or the digital nomad.
So remote work is your thing. And you know, remote work is a cousin, I suppose, to outsourcing, offshoring, BPO. It's all kind of related. And I think as people become more aware and more accepting of remote work, and as it becomes more of a norm, then it's going to benefit outsourcing and vice versa. And basically, I think we're all moving towards a concept of globalized employment as opposed to localized employment in your own hometown, having people sit in your office. That's my take on things. Would you kindly introduce us to what remote work means for you? And then, you know, we can move into exploring what running remote is. So what is remote work?
Absolutely. Well, actually, our tagline for running remote is to enable people to work whenever they want, wherever they want. And I think that tagline encompasses really what remote work is all about. Ultimately, it's improving employee happiness and business health by allowing the employees to choose their own work methodology, their own work schedules, and just being more free and therefore ending up being more productive for the company and for the business as a whole.
And it's becoming a whole movement, isn't it? And, you know, and I don't, like, you can easily see why, because it's so potentially freeing to work whenever you want, wherever you want. And of course, there's the added adventure there of sitting on a beach one day and, you know, in a city the next day. How has remote started? And, you know, why now? It's mainly the tech enablement, isn't it? But Can you give us a bit of a background as to the remote movement?
Yeah, definitely. I'll first give you a small background of how I got involved with remote work. So I'm Russian by birth, but I grew up in London in the UK, and so I'd spent some time, in the city of London, commuting daily, spending about 2 to 3 hours of commute, as my parents were living just outside of London. And so I was actually two companies that I worked for in London, and both of these companies, I was the first employee to ask to take my work back home. Back then, there wasn't any concept of remote work. So this was 12 years ago. It was just the idea of how confidential is this information that I will be, working on from home. And that information was basically not that confidential. So I was allowed. And then when I was allowed to do that for the first time, I then did it again. And both reasons were for, I didn't want to commute. So by the way, I got to the office, my mood was kind of down and I didn't want to work. And a lot of the time I would also sit in my office and realize that I've done the work for today, but I'm just not in the mood to be productive. Maybe I've done very big number of hours in the morning and I just want to go home, but I would have to sit and wait until everyone else has finished. So I found that really unproductive. I just appeared to be much more productive at home. I had done more work. I never enjoyed watercolor conversations too much. I liked them during lunch breaks, but honestly, throughout my office hours, I would always sit with my headphones, listening to music just so that I don't get distracted from work. I also like to do deep work. So if I do start on some project, I just go into it for an hour. So if anybody ever distracts me during that time, I can really put me off the rails. And that's the same as working, in an office or remotely, whenever. But ultimately, I'm more productive working from home. And that's not the same for a lot of people. So when I discovered that I can work from home in London, I then started looking out the different countries as to how can I do that. And so Asia back in 2009 was becoming a popular destination for those who can just work using their computer as a tool. So I just created an account on Upwork and I left to Bali in 2009, 11 years ago. And so been there ever since. And for me, I've seen the movement grow massively, and I'm personally really inspired by fully distributed companies. And by fully distributed companies, meaning that this company, it's a company that doesn't have any office at all, perhaps never will. There are a couple of categories of remote companies. There's fully distributed, there's remote first, there's remote friendly, and then there are hybrid models. And we're seeing a lot more and more of these show up, especially in the last couple of months during COVID. But fully distributed work model is the one I'm personally most inspired by, because those cultures without an office, those company cultures are truly unique, and the founders really have to build something special. And Time Doctor was one of those companies where I ended up having my last job at before launching Running Remote with the co-founder of Time Doctor.
And another, famous proponent of distributed workforces, of course, is Matt Mullenweg, who is the founder of Automattic, which runs WordPress, which is, there's about 30% of the world's websites built off WordPress. It's a huge organization. Yeah. And it's fully distributed. And I think Matt pretty much just roams around the world still, doesn't he? He's still very much a remote digital nomad.
Totally, yeah. We are truly inspired and led by the grandfathers of this movement. And there are a few companies that have done fascinating achievements in this space and actually contributed massively to the growth of the movement. But Zapier is one of them, and they had an office in San Francisco. Zapier is a automation tool. And they told their employees, if you will leave the office and never come back again, basically work from whatever location you want, we'll give you a stipend of $10,000 just to relocate. So things like this, got media attention and of course made people happier. And today Zapier is a very successful company, being fully distributed. So just like Automattic, fully distributed.
So that's tipping the tables completely, isn't it? Just from moving from tolerating remote work to actually encouraging their people to get out of the office. It's quite a tip, isn't it? And as you say, it's all really within the last 10 years.
Yep, absolutely.
Another big catalyst for this movement has been COVID. Coronavirus has pushed a lot of people unwittingly into home-based work, remote work. What have you seen from your perspective in terms of the move over the last 3 months to remote work?
Well, there's a lot of talk that ultimately this change in the way we work, which was forcibly applied to us, has positive long-term implications for remote work. But I do like to explore all the other side as well. And there's definitely a negative connotation to it. And that being is that we, running remote, is in the education sector. So we organize events, but we also produce quite a lot of content specifically for founders and team leaders of remote teams on how to manage and build and scale their remote organizations. And so we know that a founder that is forced to go remote without the correct education and tools and methodology is poised for a failure. And so we're going to see, I think, a lot of companies that will have a sour taste of remote work following COVID, just because it was done very forcibly and there was no plan for it. So it was no time to hire a HR manager, for example, who is experienced in remote work and apply some changes to the culture, rewrite some of the agreements, some of the labor agreements and things like that. And so I think a lot of companies and employees can't wait to get out and go back to the offices. However, every time this has been done before, and there are case studies like Bank of America, IBM, where they've gone remote, but actually by choice. And then for some reason, that program didn't work out. And everyone then went back to the office. Each time they'd lost about 20% of their creative executive team, just because they had tasted remote work, had given that opportunity, and it was taken away from them. So I do think a lot of founders can't wait to get back to the office, but they will also lose out on all those people who have now comfortably set themselves up working from home. There are definitely two ways of looking at it.
I suppose it's that balance, isn't it? And ultimately, you can't please everyone, and everyone has preferences in terms of their working styles, their lifestyles, and where they want to live as well. But is there a risk that we're running the biggest experiment ever? How to run companies efficiently? The model of working on site has obviously been happening since agriculture, the industrial age. Everyone has always needed to go to the farm or the factory or wherever, and previously then the office blocks. But now it's not actually a requirement. People don't need to physically be there. But it's been in place for about 100 years, and now there seems quite a lot of enthusiasm for being remote, working from home. But is this an experiment that isn't really fully tested out? I feel for the graduates in, they're sort of 22, they're heading up to 30 years of age, and I think that it's it sets a good foundation to go to an office, to learn off the elders, to see discipline in action. What do you think about all those aspects of the formative years of people's younger professional stint?
Well, definitely. I do think, just like with running remote, if you have in a remote organization, the best and shortest route to becoming excellent and managing it is learning from the experts. And of course, being around the office, surrounded by, as a millennial, surrounded by experts, professionals, you can learn much faster. So I do think we're going to see a lot more hybrid models, and hybrid meaning that there is an opportunity for you to go to the office if you want, but it's not obligatory. So if you ever want to work from home, you can, but there's the office space is there. And so I like programs like GitHub are doing. They have a hybrid model. But they have amazing, beautiful offices. They also have a great remote working culture to support those that are not close to anywhere at the office. But if you are close to the office, then they actually At the time they onboard somebody for the first 3 months, they make them go to the office, and then they will have a buddy there, and that buddy will basically introduce them into the organization. And I think the hybrid model is really where the future will sit. I do think that millennials being thrown into remote work right away isn't the best way for them to kind of get educated and build up confidence. But also, remote work is not for everyone by far, and you know, a lot of people get distracted and health problems with maybe self-discipline, and just, you know, a lot of people are motivated by seeing other people work in front of them, and you don't have that when you're at home. So it really needs to be tested out for who is it for, and whether that person is a fit. Having said that, I know that there are some educational institutions who are now introducing remote work and skill set of working remotely into their business studies modules. Singularity University is a university that has a compulsory module for their accelerator program. So anyone that comes up with a startup while they're being educated in a Singularity University, they have to know how to manage the organization remotely, number one, in order to launch quicker, so that you don't start off by opening a company and looking for an office. You actually start off with building something. But also, number two is to be able to survive through anything similar to COVID, because, you know, this was unprecedented. But nobody is saying that we won't have any global infrastructure lockdown repeat in the future. So for us, it also has changed a lot, where we used to say, you know, remote work is a good to have. You know, if you get it right, your business will skyrocket. But now it's not a good to have. It is an obligatory skill set. So try it, see if it works or it doesn't, and then decide which direction you'd want to go to. But at least you have to know how it works and what to do in that scenario.
It's such a good point, actually, isn't it? Like, it was a nice to have, and maybe we'll look into this, and, you know, let's look into it next year, not this year. But I think COVID has really put it on the front page, and people are now, you know, expecting that there might be resurgences of COVID, and the need for remote work to keep your operations going is now almost an essential part of strategic planning. So it's really tipped the tables, hasn't it? And of course, we've seen everyone from Facebook and Google and Twitter saying, you know, you don't need to come back to the office anymore. And I think these are the sort of globalized, or seen as the globalized thought leaders in terms of workplace norms. So it'll be incredible to see how this thing plays out. But it is interesting, you know, historically Yahoo was very much work from home, and they tended to reverse that. And Upwork, which is, you know, probably one of the best known remote platforms, they had largely an office-based organization for their own internal core team. So it's very much a mixed picture, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It is highly challenging to build a culture in a fully distributed, or, you know, even hybrid, where you have the employees that are in the office, they shouldn't feel like they're being left out if the majority of the workforce is remote. And the other way around, if you have a team of developers who are working remotely, how do you keep them engaged into what's happening in the office, because they're unable to attend maybe those weekly stand-up meetings with everyone? They can do that remotely. So I think, and also, you know, the founders, they really need to let go of a lot of micromanagement. So, like, micromanagement as a bug in an organization can be solved with the help of remote work. But of course, both of these big projects, and, you know, this is just two very large topics in transitioning into remote work as a on-site organization or on-premise organization. These are very, very challenging to take on, and a lot of founders and CEOs are, I would say, a little bit fearful about letting go, about maybe even uncovering potential caveats in the way the organization is run. Because once you don't have an office, you fully rely on processes so that everyone knows what they're doing without, you know, constant day-to-day guidance. It breeds entrepreneurial spirit, but it's a very challenging thing to do, and also to change a culture in a way that, you know, we're no longer all wearing the same t-shirt with the same logo. There is something else, something like ethereal that unites us. And to build that and transition to that, it's highly challenging. So I do see why some other larger companies, you know, they do implement remote work very, very slowly. And definitely COVID has just accelerated that on a massive scale. And it's amazing to see Google and Facebook catching up with flexible labor contracts where they do allow workers to work from home when and where they want. And I do think that's slightly delayed.
Yeah, it seems a double-edged sword that, you know, 20 years ago, this wasn't possible. And by the way, that's a fantastic thing, because if coronavirus happened 20 years ago, I think it would have just absolutely stopped the entire economy. You know, you couldn't have people working remotely back then, whereas now technology has enabled that, and people may not have been that conversant with Zoom, but they could quickly get on Zoom and the tools were there. So it's, you know, it's lucky that coronavirus happened in this part of the century. But anecdotally, you know, I lived in a co-living space in Javier in Spain, which attracts a lot of digital nomads. And, you know, I was there for almost 10 weeks, and I saw a lot of entrepreneurs, and a lot of them weren't doing a lot of work, you know, and these are cool places, they're fun places, and it's better and more fun to go out surfing instead of doing that the boring work, you know, and especially when it's sunny outside. And it's really hard to sit in front of your laptop when other people are having fun. So it's finding that balance, isn't it? And I think ultimately people will be valued and assessed based on their productivity and whether they are suited to that lifestyle and whether they have the discipline.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it really is the location that allows me to feel good or bad. It really has an effect on my overall well-being and mindset. And so I choose Bali because, like, my house is positioned in front of a nice river. I've got no neighbors in my vicinity. You know, I'm in the middle of Ubud. So every morning when I wake up and I think, like, oh well, I wished, you know, this project that I'm working on right now, that my co-founder would be here around the table and we just went through it in half an hour. But now I'm going to have to wait until he wakes up in 12 hours because he's in Canada and I'm in Bali, which is an exact 12-hour difference. And then, but then again, I look at this river and I realize, well, yes, there are these disadvantages, but I have this amazing view and remote work allows me to have this. And it also allows me just to, frankly, wear any t-shirt I want. You know, and so there are certain big advantages which should be leveraged to kind of like solve the disadvantages. But if you're uncomfortable managing an organization remotely, then it shouldn't be really forced into. I think just one needs to understand the way it's run in case something happens, or, you know, you one day lose an office space and the business doesn't stop. But definitely it's not for everyone.
Well, I'm certainly so excited about the remote movement, and I think that it's moving everyone towards globalized workforce and globalized employment, which I think is better for everyone, for the entire world, for the economies of the world, for people across the world. And there's going to be less inequality, as, you know, everyone has equal access to opportunities. It will now be based on a meritocracy and the quality of your output, as opposed to where you were born or necessarily what university you went to. So it's super exciting. And of course, a sub branch of that is outsourcing and BPOs, which the Philippines is connected to. Tell us about the Running Remote. You are based in Bali, and Running Remote has been going for 2 or 3 years now. And of course, the inaugural conference was in Bali. Tell us a little bit about Running Remote and what the motivation was for starting this off. This podcast is brought to you by Outsource Accelerator. We are the world's leading outsourcing marketplace and advisory. We help big and small businesses with their outsourcing needs, and we can help you too. We cover everything from business and staffing strategy, optimal outsourcing structures, implementations, and fully managed services. If you're already outsourcing, about to start or somewhere in between, then we can ensure that you get the best from outsourcing. That's the best prices, best terms, and of course, the best results from your outsourcing practices. We list over 700 outsourcing suppliers on our website, host this leading outsourcing podcast, and have over 5,000 pages of content. Because we span the entire market, we can ensure that you get the best deal possible. We offer everything from light brokerage, co-managed services, through to fully managed solutions. Get in touch today. Visit us at outsourceaccelerator.com/quote. Mention that you're a podcast listener, and we will give you special attention plus a 10% discount. This is for a limited time only. Go to outsourceaccelerator.com/quote.
Sure. Well, at the time I was working at Time Doctor, which is a productivity analytics tool for remote teams, and they're a 100-person company, fully distributed, never had an office, never will, and that's been the model for 11 or 12 years now. And so for me, that was, I've been working remotely for a long time, but this was the first time I was a part of a fully operational, full-time team of 90 people, right? So this is not freelancers who work here and there and sip a coconut on the beach and kind of, you know, live that digital nomad style. These are really people who are working from home. 95% of those people, they have, you know, office setups. And we went to a company retreat, and it was, we discussed many interesting topics. Some of the silly ones were even like, do we have video by default? And how do we manage if somebody wants to speak in the meeting? Should we use emojis to kind of show the emotion behind this plain text that we see in Slack? And and I'd never heard any of these things, and yet they're so important for remote work to be successful. And so I had an idea of maybe we should bring other founders of remote companies to see how are they solving these challenges. And when I mentioned this to Liam, co-founder of Time Doctor and my employer at the time, he was like, well, I'm sure there are a bunch of other companies who have this information, but instead of inviting them to one of our company retreats, maybe we should just make an event out of it. So we went and Googled and realized there were no conferences. And back in London, I actually was in the events industry for about 6 years. So events weren't really foreign to me. And it was something interesting at the time to kind of try and see if anybody is interested. So we decided to poll Time Doctor clients and just asked if they would be interested in getting together and sharing ideas on and tips and tactics and strategies on how they manage their remote organizations. And many of them said yes. And so I went back to Bali from the Philippines, by the way, that company retreat was in Boracay. And we started to form a minimal viable product, which was an event for 150 people. And somebody from our company said, you know, if you get 20 people fly in, 20 founders of serious companies to fly in all the way to Bali to discuss this matter, and if you get 20 of those, this is going to be a success. So we had 216 people show up at our first conference. So instantly we knew that we struck some kind of chord. And the chord really, which was the same as the motivation behind it, was the lack of education, the lack of information and guidance in the internet, for that matter, anywhere in the world, on how to scale remote organizations. We're now seeing a lot more content, but this was in 2018. So learning directly from experts, of course, is, you know, it's been the most solid channel for education for years. And so we are focused at presenting successful founders on the stages of our events, who then share those tactics with people who are just entering remote work or actually looking to scale their remote organization from 10 to maybe 50 people. We've had two conferences in Bali, and Bali became a kind of destination conference. So not only you go to a conference to discuss remote work, but you're also in one of the coolest locations. And so I think that drew in a lot of speakers, but we quickly realized that there are many, many people who can't do that, who are simply, you know, engaged in their lives. It's a 30-hour flight. They want to absorb the content. They're unable to fly. And the majority of those founders were located in the U.S., so we decided to make the move, and we had announced our conference in Austin for April 2020. The conference was a sellout, and 1 month before the event, COVID struck, Texas announced the state of disaster, and basically we had to pivot online.
Yeah, and it's kind of ironic that, isn't it? Because, you know, it is remote and it's remote first, yet people fundamentally still want to meet up, don't they? People still want to form a real community of real interaction. And also, I think that learning can be more effective when you're actually there in person. You can answer questions and things like that. And you have done incredibly well because events companies, you know, a lot of them have collapsed as a result of COVID. But you have, you've quickly pivoted. And despite the April 1 being postponed until next year, what have you done since Corona? You've doubled down on the conference thing.
Yeah, well, it's true. The only way for us to survive and for any event company to survive right now is to have some kind of online event strategy. And I was very skeptical and dubious about online events. I honestly, we at our live conferences, we never had a live stream pass. We always said that, like, if you want to join the conference, get away from your remote computer or your home office setup, close it, fly in and talk to real people, make real connections. We never believed in virtual conferences as such. But we had discovered that the innovation in the event space for hosting events online has been incredible, especially during COVID time. Some of the features that the platforms where you can host your online events enable things that are even not possible at live events. And I was really drawn to that, and also realized that, well, this is actually not only a way to survive, but it's a muscle that we can grow and pump and actually sustain a community online, because it became much more than a live stream. It's much more than one-way kind of communication. People can interact, people can network with each other, they can go on calls within the platform, they can filter by, you know, the attendees to see who they want to chat to. I mean, you can't really be at a 1,000 people event and be like, right, where do I find, you know, this person such and such. You really have to go through all of them. I mean, online, you can just look at the list of attendees and be like, right, this is the person, let's ping them. You can be in two places at once. You know, you can be watching a talk with a video inset inside of your tab, and at the same time, you can be chatting to someone. I mean, that's very difficult to do at a live conference scenario. You can also go back and see the talk recordings right away. If you, in case you missed a session that took place half an hour, again, you can't do that at live conferences. We found that it's just a way to attract more people who were never able to make it to Running Remote. And then in the long run, we are looking to actually turn our live conference into a hybrid conference. So yes, like, remote work is a topic that it has no borders, and we want we had quite a few people from Asia who had attended Bali conferences, frustrated that they can't make it to the US because of the visa problems, you know. And we do have an audience in Bangladesh and, you know, in Pakistan, and we have audiences all over the place. Becoming a hybrid event will essentially mirror what's happening at the live event in an online events platform. And then all those people will be able to attend and also learn at the same time. So it's been an exciting time for us. We're doing free events just because we realized that a lot of companies right now are going through stress due to remote work challenges. And we didn't really want to monetize on that. So we just said, you know, let's just educate people for free. And then, of course, we have a couple of sponsors who support these events to keep the company afloat. But it's been a very, very exciting few times. And we've organized two virtual conferences so far. And we have three more conferences planned before the end of the year, all online.
It's incredible, isn't it? It's, you know, and it's no mean feat to pivot so quickly and you know, go live within a number of weeks. And I find this whole thing fascinating, you know, because a Hollywood movie, you know, they're saying people's attention spans are getting shorter and shorter, and a 30-second clip is too long. And, you know, Hollywood spends maybe $100 million to produce a two-hour movie, and even those can be pretty boring and hard to capture your attention for the entire 2 hours. And yet, you know, you're running a two-day conference, and it's hours and hours of content, and, you know, potentially then as well you charge for that content, which is becoming harder and harder to do. It's fascinating how content is presenting itself in different levels and how people are choosing to engage. But it's becoming increasingly hard, I think, to cut through the noise of all the different types of content. But when you hit on something and resonate, then people really do respond, don't they?
Absolutely, yeah. And we just make sure that you know, all our speakers have speaking experience, apart from being experts in the field, that they're engaging. And you know, to keep the engagement online is far more challenging than to keep it in a live conference scenario. You know, you can always head off to the buffet or to the networking zone or to the expo zone and be shown some demo. And here you're sitting in front of a computer. And if there's a talk that doesn't really resonate with you, you're going to want to either leave or check out what else is happening at the events. It's really difficult to keep the attention and the events engaged, and we keep on, you know, we're not great at it, and we're still constantly changing the way the conferences run. So like the conference that you'd spoken to, Derek, which was back in June, just a couple of weeks ago, was a 2-day conference. And we realized that on the second day wasn't attended by as many people as the first day. And so now we're organizing a 1-day conference. So it's all trial and error. We're constantly iterating. And I think it's just not being afraid and really being in this startup agile mode. And like I said, the events, innovation in the online space has just been incredible. The features are really exciting and powerful.
Are there any insights that you have gleaned over the last sort of 2 or 3 events that you've run? Because I, you know, if people leave, you know, do they pop in and pop out, or if they leave, then they've left the whole time? And in terms of the format, is it you know, you're trying to keep it punchy and active? And what different formats have you experimented with?
Yeah, well, the networking is very important. So, an ability for attendees to go on calls with each other inside the platform. So, having a platform which has a one-to-one video calling feature is really important, and that can enable your attendees to stay on for longer. But yes, people do drop in, drop out. Everyone can schedule the sessions they want. So maybe they schedule one session in the morning, one session in the evening. But at our first event, we had 3 tracks. So we had three talks at any one time. Plus we had the networking room open. And we had more than 600 people live every minute of that six hours. We had more than 600 people live for about five hours, and then for the last 3 hours we had more than 400 people live. So that didn't happen at our last event because we decided to make it a bit simpler and or spread it over 2 days. So that's why we're going back to 1 day and just jam-packed with lots of different content.
Yeah, it's incredible. So I encourage anyone, you know, this is just a quick plug, but anyone to go and check it out. How do they find out about Running Remote?
Yeah, it's runningremote.com. Go to the events section, click on virtual conferences, and you can sign up for free.
Fantastic. And that wasn't the end of the podcast, but it's good to get that in there. But where do you see this ending up? Now, it's only because of technology that we are able to work remotely, and it's only because of technology that the work that we do can be done remotely. You know, we're now dealing with bytes instead of bricks. And in 20, 30, 40 years from now, do you expect there to be no offices? Or, you know, are we all going to be working globally? Where do you see this heading?
I do think we're going to have a hybrid model applied predominantly through organizations. So you still have an office or headquarters, but the possibility for employees to work from home is very, very big. And I think it'll make a lot of people happier. It'll make people more productive and businesses grow faster. But, you know, having some sort of central place where you can go to and speak to real people is a growing importance for fully distributed companies. And even someone like Zapier, Wade Foster, who is the CEO, you know, has been a major proponent, just like Matt Malomek from Automattic, about remote work, but only recently has started talking on podcasts that maybe they're going to reintroduce the office as an option in where and when you can work. So I think that's going to be the future. I do miss, of course, real people quite a lot. And that's why, you know, company retreats for distributed organizations are so important, because it's just, you know, the depth of relationship that you can build in a matter of 2 days or even a couple of hours of being face to face with someone is quite incredible, until the time when it starts to become destructive. Then you got to go back and work from home. But I do think the hybrid model is going to be the one that's we're going to see much more of in 20 years' time. And of course, we don't know where the technology is going, but I'm talking to VR companies, virtual reality companies, who are building incredible technology for people to have those virtual meetings, but kind of take it to the next level than just the Skype and the Zoom that we use every day, and actually seeing things in 3D and meeting in real places that look real. And hard to say where it's all going to go to, but the innovation is moving at an incredibly fast pace for remote workers.
How do you think this will affect the geopolitical kind of aspect? You know, I've always been amazed that geopolitically, labor force has always been restricted in terms of movement. And, you know, maybe coming from Russia, you're aware of that. Like, people are physically stopped from crossing borders, and therefore what they could do, how they work, is all sort of managed by the state. And I think now, certainly in 40 years from now, the relevance of borders in terms of workforces will be completely gone. And, you know, people like Trump are trying to discourage what he refers to as outsourcing, but it's not really possible, because we're all working online, and then we become one globalized community. And you know, relevant to that is the taxes people pay, where you pay taxes, employment contracts and things like that. Do you think all of this will need to be completely sort of thrown away and rewritten in terms of globalized law and migration and employment?
I do think so. I think that the immigration laws are going to have to update themselves, and it can be followed by countries like Estonia, for example, and like Thailand. They've all had attempts, and I think Estonia has actually succeeded in rolling out a digital nomad visa. So, you know, digital nomads are a huge opportunity for the economy, just like Bali had seen. Bali is full of foreigners, and many of them are working remotely thanks to the organizations that allow that, and they all have a buck to spend, so they all rent properties, they all want to eat somewhere, right? So it's massive, and to be able to just like not let those people in because they don't have clear kind of working visa, or let them out, in fact, as an organization. I think this is all hindrances to the global economic opportunity. Estonia has rolled out this visa. It instantly saw quite a big influx of professionals who don't need a desk to sit on. So they actually cost the economy less to sustain. All they need is they pay rent for an apartment which has an office space in it. And I think that's definitely the future. But you know, the US is struggling a little bit, and the US there are many organizations that are remote, that are American organizations, and they're only remote within the US. So they have employees spread out across the different states of United States of America. But, you know, internationally distributed teams are those that are fascinating, because they have different cultures, they have different, you know, of course, access to talent as well. You know, you can hire somebody from the Philippines, but the way contractor labor laws are structured at the moment, and again, it differs from state to state, but California recently upgraded their labor laws to actually consider contractors as legit employees and have access to perks and things like that that full-time employees have at the company. I think more states should do that, and I think America should definitely open up and for those distributed companies to actually become geographically distributed. There's still a lot to learn, but there are amazing case studies out there already of countries succeeding in this.
And just briefly, I want to touch on productivity tools. You previously worked for Time Doctor, and that's connected to running remote, and it's a productivity tool that's synonymous with the freelancer space. But what are your thoughts on productivity tools? You know, it seems that the only universal productivity tools really are the most basic ones, like email and a Google Doc, effectively, and everything above and beyond that in terms of complexity and functionality, there you know, it seems that there are so many different preferences. I might like to use Asana, which is a productivity tool. You might like to use Trello, which is more of a to-do list. Do you see in the future, and then of course there's Time Doctor, which maybe you can just briefly explain, but do you see in the future, as we need more sort of management of productivity and alignment of productivity, there will be a convergence on a sort of normalized productivity tool?
I think for anyone starting out, it is like a rule of thumb to get yourself a task management app, or if the company it tells you that you have to use this particular tool, do use it, because it develops and breeds amazing skills and very, very, very useful habits that may stick with you for life, and they will help you being productive. Now, there's a danger of overly relying on those productivity tools, and they can end up being a distraction, where all you're doing all day long is actually sorting which tasks are need to be done by priority. So we want to avoid that. Personally, I use a time tracker to be able to account to have accountability with myself on how long I've worked for. Because my work is not limited by amount of hours spent at the office anymore, I want to make sure that I don't overwork or underwork, right? So sometimes I'm sitting in front of the computer and I realize, oh wow, I've already been here for 2 hours, but I only know that because I actually time myself working. And also, if you do use a time tracker, or if you do use a task manager like us, and then you're working in a particular task, you're in that zone that you've told yourself, this is the task I'm working on. You've actually made the tick in Asana, and so it gets you in this work zone. So I do find those things very, very important, and very useful, but not to overly rely on them. And some people need more of those. Some people have a bigger capacity of their brain to store things, but what was that book that said that our brain is not meant for actually storing things? Use checklists.
Yeah, get things done, yeah.
Exactly. So yeah, be organized. But I do think that they will somehow all merge into one. And I mean, Google is doing amazing in terms of trying to merge all those tools into one, because obviously everything is linked to Gmail and Google Calendar, etc. I don't know if you've seen, but I think just a couple of weeks ago they released the tasks feature, where you can now have tasks instead of Google.
I've always found them a little bit behind in terms of sophistication, and I think they're just trying to stick to the basics that work instead of kind of overextending and then having people, I suppose, disengage. Yeah. Because it's the what I find with productivity tools is the more advanced and the more functionality that they have, the harder they are to learn, and then the harder they are to comply with over time, because they, as you say, they almost become the tail wagging the dog. And whereas the basic ones, they're basic, but then so it's easy to adopt, but then there's limitations. And I find, just going deeper into that, with outsourcing, we often have clients come to us to help with their productivity aspect, and it's never one size fits all, and people might have their preferences or softwares or tools that they're already using or integrated with, and then there's a huge switching cost, like emotionally and operationally, to that. So I think it could be a long time, yeah, before there's more standardized tools out there.
Definitely, but I do think if you have a weaker company culture and not clearly defined values and a way to engage your distributed employees with each other on an ongoing recurring basis, then none of those tools will actually save you. I think a sense of belonging for an employee to the company's vision, that what the work that they're doing actually has a bigger impact than the completion of this task. It has a bigger impact on the whole success of the company. Being able to provide feedback, knowing how to provide feedback in an online space, it's all very difficult to do. I think those are really the essential habits that managers need to learn, as opposed to working out which tool stack is important. I mean, this question is asked all the time at our conferences. What tool stack do you use? What tool stack do you use? And guess what? Everyone uses the same tools. There isn't a secret sauce to this. It's more about how do you apply those tools and how do they fit into your company culture. And I think there's a lot of work done to be done there.
Yeah, it's a little bit, and I find this, and again, I find this with remote work as well. Like I'm a disciplined guy. I go to the gym and I work out, but if if I'm not in the right environment, I am the laziest guy in the world. You know, it's very hard to work out if you're not in the right environment. And I think with these productivity tools, you know, we all know how to be fit and healthy, but it's actually, so we all have these tools, but it's actually just consciously doing it, isn't it? You know, and sometimes that's harder said than done. And I know myself, you know, I'm terrible with to-do lists. Like I set up a to-do list and then suddenly I have 1,000 to-dos and then I just don't go back to it because it takes so much time
Well,
to manage
I
them.
think overly relying on them is maybe can be a problem, but I just give you a different example. As we're getting to the end of this podcast, you might know this meditation app that's installed in the phones called Headspace. It's like an
I do it every morning.
Okay. Well, I actually went to their one of their first pitches that they did just before they launched in London. I listened to the pitch. I was quite inspired by the whole proof of concept and, you know, just launching the product. So I came up to the founder and I asked him this one question. So I was very curious to know whether you think that this will actually produce over dependency on the technology. As meditation, what it's supposed to allow you to do is that you're not, you know, you're just with your mind. You're not depending on anything, and you don't need to interact with any device. You actually want to switch off your brain completely and just be with yourself. So do you think that actually this is counterintuitive, that I have, you know, somebody has to rely on an application and engage with it in order to meditate? And he's answered pretty, you know, pretty frankly that there can be this risk. However, what it does is it develops a habit. And so the way you use this habit, that's much more important than which technology, and do you even rely on technology or not? So even like to do task managers, once you develop a habit of how it works and how to structure your and prioritize your days, you may not need those apps anymore, where you just have them, but not do not over rely on them. That's the way I see this. And again, with Headspace, I think once you've meditated for a year, you probably can do it might as well without the app itself.
It's fascinating, isn't it? And I think it comes back to the structure and the discipline and the frameworks, they actually ultimately set you free. And I think that you can't be free if you have no structure or framework. It's just everything's a bit of a mess, but you need
That's right.
the kind of structured environment, and then you reach that kind of creative freedom and space
That's right.
that we're all after. Fascinating, Igor. It's been an incredible conversation. Again, if anyone wants to get in touch with you or learn more about running remote, how can they do that?
It's Igor at Running Remote, Igor with an E, or LinkedIn, Igor Running Remote. You'll always find me there. I'm happy to answer any questions, always available. Thanks a lot, Derek. It's been a very interesting conversation. I'm very passionate about this topic. I really want to see this grow, and I hope we'll meet again at one of our future events.
That was Igor Barushko of the Running Remote Conference. If you want to get in touch with Igor or see any of the links or any of the information that we mentioned in this podcast, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. And as always, if you want to ask us anything, send us questions to ask@outsourceaccelerator.com. See you next time.